مرحبا, شالوم, and welcome to another episode by the Ropescast, the only alternative view of the Middle East.
I'm Ksenia Svitlova.
And I'm Ibrahim Abu Ahmed.
And today in our new episode, we have a very special guest with whom we will discuss Saudi Arabia, the latest developments between the kingdom and regional powers, Iran, Israel, and the future, the vision of 2030. Our guest today is Yossi Fischer, who is an expert on international tourism and consultant.
And we thank you again for being with us on another episode, and we hope that you enjoy this episode and you continue to listen to all our podcasts now and in the future.
Ibrahim, what do you feel about visiting Saudi Arabia?
Honestly, I've never been. I was never been there for Umrah, definitely not for Hajj. But it's certainly on my list. I have friends from Jeddah who've been begging me for years to come and visit, but it's never been the case. Have you been there since you've been to Egypt and Lebanon and all these countries that nobody expects?
I wish, but Saudi Arabia, unfortunately for me, it didn't happen so far. It was always a dream. I think for anybody who is dealing with the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, the Forbidden Kingdom, there was a movie at the time, I think by CNN, that was produced by this name, the Forbidden Kingdom. There is a mystery, this religious aura, of course, of the leader of the Islamic world. And of course, now, very intriguingly, the changes, the new wind that we feel that is coming from the Saudi Arabia, I'm very intrigued. And with all of the news, well, maybe spins by politicians, yes, who know. And this is exactly what we will be discussing today with Yossi, about the possibility that also Israelis at some point will be able to visit Saudi Arabia, just as we are visiting Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Manama, and Rabat today.
Well, I can't wait to hear from our guest all about that, and let's welcome him now.
Yossi, hello, shalom, and marhaba.
Marhaba, shalom, how are you? Great speaking to you.
How are you? Are you with us today in Israel? Are you in the kingdom? Where are we catching you?
No, you're catching me actually in Israel, getting ready for Ramadan and Passover.
Yeah, we're ready for... Listen, I mean, as soon as Ksenia said the introduction, 1,000 questions just popped into my head. Unlimited number of questions that I would love to ask you. And thank you so much for being with us today. But I think let's start with the most basic and simple questions, I think, and we'll dive in. First of all, what brings a Jewish Israeli person to look at Saudi Arabia, of all places, as a target location for tourism, for prospering tourism, and even to visit the country? What brought you to Saudi Arabia, of all places?
Well, I'm watching Saudi Arabia for the past 4 years, and I plan to go to Saudi Arabia actually earlier, when Saudi Arabia opened for international tourism shortly before the coronavirus happened. So I was planning to go in 2019. Unfortunately, my trip was delayed, and then I had to postpone it to 2022. The kingdom is going through a major changes that are visible from the outside and much from the inside. So I used the opportunity of being a writer and got an invitation to the world conference that took place back in December 2022, and I got an official invitation, and I used it to visit the kingdom.
So take us back to that moment. You arrive for the first time in Saudi Arabia. You bring your Israeli passport. What do people tell you? What are the impressions?
Were you scared?
No, I wasn't scared. I was looking forward to it because I already visited Arab countries much earlier before. I visited Oman back in 1995. When the late Shimon Peres was still foreign minister, so I've visited Qatar much before the Abraham Accords, and I visited the Emirates, Dubai, and Abu Dhabi back in 2013. So I wasn't scared, and I was traveling on a dual citizenship. I have a European passport, so it was a major thrill, and I was looking forward to it. I was actually getting ready to travel to Saudi Arabia for the last 3 years, so I was looking anxiously to go there.
Yossi, you know, during my journalistic and academic career, I read quite a few books on Saudi Arabia, almost always dreamt to visit there, but there was not a chance, unfortunately, so far, maybe in the future, who knows. For quite a long time, there was the image of Saudi Arabia of something very specific, a very religious, very conservative, very closed society, with an option, of course, for the Muslims to participate in the Hajj and Umrah. But for everybody else, it was the Forbidden Kingdom. So can you please walk us through this change? What happened in Saudi Arabia? Why, this sudden openness for foreigners, for tourists, for guests who are not necessarily coming either for business or for religious purposes?
In one word, I'll make it short and simple. MBS. MBS is the reason for the change. MBS is the change. And everything surrounds MBS's vision, Prince MBS vision, Vision Saudi 2030. So you see the whole kingdom is geared up towards this huge change that is happening. And it is happening on a daily basis. You feel it in the streets. You see it. You talk to people and they talk about it. Forget about Wahhabism. Wahhabism was there for 300 years. And now for the last 3 years, during the corona virus, it changed. And it is changing. I can give you numerous examples of how you feel the change, how you see the change. It is there with everyone you speak to.
Yossi, just a following question before my colleague Ibrahim will pop another one. Do you also believe that this is a societal change? I mean, you know, the protests for women that wanted to have the opportunity to ride a car happened way before Mohammed bin Salman. And young people who wanted reforms, who wanted changes, probably, maybe, they are the same people who are very supportive of MBS. And when he does these changes and these reforms, he knows that he can count on some constituency inside the kingdom. There are women, young people, emerging leaders who are open to the world and want to see their kingdom develop and open up.
It wasn't a question, Ksenia. It's actually what you were saying is actually what's happening. You have 70% of the population is below 35 in age, and that population is driving the change. And MBS is basing his entire support base on that population. You see a lot of highly educated people. At least the people I met. And I made it a point also to speak to the locals. And my impression is that, you see women as tour guides. You see women as tourism specialists. Actually, the deputy tourism minister is Princess Haifa bin Saud, who is from the royal family. And you see the ambassador, the ambassador to the U.S., is a Saudi princess, so you see more and more women taking part in that huge change. I saw the women driving in the street, so you feel it. I was speaking to the young ladies that they told me about their day to day life and how they cope and how they see the change. So it's evident, it's there, and it's something you can talk to people about.
So what's that begs the question, what's the next step? You know, we're seeing these changes. I think every Israeli will ask Is Saudi Arabia the next one to join the Abraham Accords? Is that something that we can see in the foreseeable future? Because I, from my understanding of the Saudi society, there is a sense that Saudi is not ready yet for that drastic of a change. What's your view on that?
I think that part of the change is going to be when the regime, when the kingdom will pass on to His Majesty, to His Majesty MBS, the Prince MBS. He's basically running the country now, but he still has a lot of elderly people around him that belong to his father's generation. Once this will happen, and the younger generation will take over formally, I think that the change will happen. It's not going to be the Abrahamic Accords. Let's put things in perspective.
Okay,
The
that's a great
Abrahamic
point.
Accords, the Abrahamic Accords were signed with the United Arab Emirates and with the Kingdom of Bahrain, and on the sidelines also with Morocco. Morocco is a different story, but let's focus on the UAE and Bahrain. Those countries would have never ever signed the Abrahamic Accords without the permission, the specific permission of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. This happened because Saudi Arabia gave its permission. They are the big boys in the neighborhood, and nothing would have happened without their consent. So I believe that eventually it would take time. Maybe it would take another regime change here in Israel. But I think that we'll have a open diplomatic relationship with the kingdom before Vision 2030. I believe that even much before Vision 2030. If you look now, for example, the recent agreement between Israel and the Sultanate of Oman to allow Israeli planes to pass over Oman wouldn't have been brokered without the Saudi silent consent. This simply couldn't happen in this region.
Yossi, I wanted to ask you if we are talking about Israeli-Saudi relations. Well, we are hearing more and more in the last few months, specifically since the initiation of the current Israeli government, that Saudis are bringing back again the issue of the Arab Peace Initiative. Turki Al-Faisal, the ex-ambassador of Saudi Arabia in the United States, said just 2 days ago, a few days ago, to France Van Katter that there will be no peace between the countries before there will be substantial change on the Palestinian track. What do you make of this? Do we see the revival of the Arab Peace Initiative? And in general, when you visited the kingdom, what do you feel? What is the sentiment in regards to the Palestinians and relations to them?
Well, I can refer to what only to what I've experienced, and I was there for 1 week, so it doesn't give you much perspective. But from the talks I held, yes, the Palestinian issue is an issue. It's something that is in the background. However, they don't see their relations with Israel. As it's not a make it or break it. I don't see it this way. I believe that the first and foremost interest of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is to see the shift in their economy, and to have this shift in their economy from a fossil based economy to a service tourism economy. They need a peace with the neighbors, and that's why also you see now what is happening with the Iranians. It's not really a peace that it's not a peace agreement with the Iranians. It's a long-term hudna. The rivalries will remain, but in order to achieve the dream, in order to achieve the vision of a Saudi 2030 they need peace and quiet. In peace and quiet, we are also neighbors. We are far away neighbors. However, we are neighbors. So I believe that maybe it's not going to be a diplomatic relations in the first phase, but I think that the first phase will be probably based on religious basis. We will see flights going from Tel Aviv to Jeddah and the flights going from Eilat to Jeddah for Muslim pilgrims, either Palestinians or Israeli Muslims. And I think this is going to be not in this Hajj, but in the next Hajj, maybe in 2024. But I believe this is
dramatic, Yossi. Wow, this is a scoop.
Yes, they are talking about it. They are talking about it because the one thing that Saudi wants to show to the world is that they are the home for the Muslims. And Muslims, we have almost 1.8 million Muslims in Israel, and there are millions of Palestinian Muslims in a Palestinian Authority that want to go to Umrah and Hajj. And the way now that they have to travel is a nightmare. And it costs a fortune. And they want to make it affordable.
80,000, 40,000 shekel, if I'm not mistaken, to go to Hajj.
Yes, 40, but 000. you're calculating based on a bus ride from the Allenby Bridge to Jeddah. And when you're talking and you're calculating the flights in, it's going to be more expensive. Wow. Even more expensive.
So tell me, Yossi, now going back a little bit to the more difficult side of things, as you mentioned, you foresee Israeli-Saudi relations before we reach 2030. And my question, since we always go back to the issue of the intervention and the ability of the region to influence the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, how do you see Saudi's role, or how do you wish to see Saudi's role in the conflict and in prospering discussions? What should Saudi start with, at least? Where do we start from?
It's the million real question. I can't even give you the answer, because when you're looking at Saudi in contrast to Israel, their perspective is a strategic one. They look at things on 10 years, 20 years, 30 years ahead. In Israel, we tend to look at things at the term of an average government, which is about 2 years. So we don't look at things on a strategic level. They look at things at a strategic level. How do they see a solution to the Palestinian Israeli conflict? I wouldn't even dare to dream to tell you. However, I believe that in the past, the Saudis were into the idea of having a confederacy between the West Bank and Jordan. They believed in the past, at least. I don't know now. I'm not a politics expert. I'm a tourism and travel expert. But they would like to stabilize the kingdom. They would like to stabilize the Hashemite kingdom. And the reason for that is very, very simple. Their largest showcase project is on the Jordanian border. And I'm talking about NEOM. NEOM project is a $2 trillion project. $2 trillion project. And it's smack on the Jordanian border. They need to see the Jordanian kingdom stabilized. And they will do everything in their power to see Jordan stabilized. Jordan has a majority of 70% Palestinians. So they probably would look into a solution that will find a way to make a confederacy between the Hashemite kingdom and the West Bank.
Well, you see, I think that this is encouraging news to everybody who is tuning to us, because everybody knows that for us in Israel, our longest border is with Jordan too. And stability of Jordan means also stability for Israel in our eastern border, the so-called Eastern Front. So stability for Saudi, stability for Jordan, eventually means stability for the Palestinians. I think that everybody who is supporting the idea of conflict resolution based on two states must be optimistic in this regard, because yes, politics and economics always go together. And building on your expertise as a tourist expert, I would want to ask you, let's imagine that dream came true. There are planes that leave from Ben-Gurion and go to Jeddah and Riyadh and other destinations in Saudi Arabia. If I'm a tourist that wants to visit a kingdom today, where should I go? Historical places, Neom that is now is rising up. But what is there to see? Because for now, I think that most of the Israelis had this specific idea of Mecca, Medina, and well, nothing much in between, a lot of oil, and men in Galabia and women in niqab, but camels too.
And a lot of deserts.
Desert and camels, yes. But I read your Twitter religiously, I would say, and a different picture arises from there. Can you tell us, please, a little bit about that?
Let's get into some numbers. There are currently in the kingdom 180,000 archaeological excavation sites that are marked as excavation site to be digged. Can you imagine how much history, how much wealth of culture is lying underneath the sands? They are looking now to get thousands and thousands of archaeologists from all over the world to start those excavations. Some even believe that the Mount of Sinai is not Santa Catarina. It's actually in the area of Neom in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Some archaeologists believe that theory. And it needs to be excavated, the entire region. So, from a historical viewpoint, from a cultural viewpoint, Saudi has so much to offer that it's now just opening. This is why they're trying now to sell Saudi in the world, not only as a religious destination, not only as the place of the two mosques, but also as a historical place, as a resort destination with the Red Sea project under development. You're talking
and
about
beautiful
one
reefs, right?
You're talking about one region, which is the size, it's bigger than the size of Israel and the West Bank together. You're talking about 28,000 kilometers in just one destination, and that's a standalone destination. Wow. It has everything in it. It has its own electric support. It has its own airport, its own water destillation. Everything is separated from the rest of the kingdom. So this is a destination standing for its own. You have Al Ula, which is a World Heritage Site, much bigger than Petra, but also built by the Nabatis, that is a destination that is picking up rapidly now in the world, and it's they are building the entire infrastructure around it.
The sake of our listeners, explain in two sentences what is Al Ula, from what time is it, and what you can see there, but just briefly.
Al Ula is a city built by the Nabatean people, which was built during the Greek Roman period, and it's carved in stones. It is an amazing destination. Actually, it's on my next to see list in my next trip to the kingdom, and it's to people that have been to Petra, you can do in half a day. If you go to Al Ula, you need at least 3 to 4 days just traveling to see the stone carvings, to see the monuments. It's huge in size, and it's smack in the middle of the desert.
Incredible.
Ibrahim, we need a lot of vacation. We have to gear up for this.
I mean, Ksenia is the executive director, so she needs to give me those days off.
We'll go together as a field trip for the team.
But let me ask you one quick question, Yossi. I mean, if we see these relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia opening up, I have no idea. I have no doubt that Israelis will be going, because Israelis are big travelers and they go all over the world. But the question is the other way around, because what we've seen so far from the Abraham Accords, that the tourism to Israel from these countries has been very, very, very minimal, probably under 100 people a year. We're talking outside of delegations, outside of official business. People visiting has been very much almost non-existent. Do you see something different for Saudi Arabia, or do you perceive some of the same, and how can we change it?
Well, first of all, you have to remember that when you're talking to about the United Arab Emirates, you're talking about 9 million people, out of which about 1.1 million are locals. When you're talking about Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, you're talking about 36 million locals. That's a different ballgame. I believe that what is happening with the UAE and with Bahrain,
even Morocco is not coming.
No, it's something to do with the Israeli image. When you're opening the papers, you're opening the Saudi papers, and you see a front page cover about the pogrom in Huwara. I don't see many Arabs coming to
villages and clashes.
Exactly. I don't see many Arabs from those countries coming over. It needs time. However, from the other side, Israelis, once you open for them a destination, they will jump on it because they want to be the first there. It happened with the United Arab Emirates. I can give you some data. In 2022, 500,000 Israelis visit the United Arab Emirates. That's a huge number. And that's within 2 years. 500,000. Can you imagine? Israel is on the top 10 in terms of visitors to the UAE. And they consider Israel to be one of their main destinations. And we are a small country. And we're not talking about the flight connections, because if you're talking about the flight connectivity, then the numbers are much, much higher, because the Israelis are flying via mm-hmm. Dubai and via Bahrain and via Abu Dhabi to the Far East. So those numbers are much, much higher if you're taking also the transit into account. So I think that in order for Israel to have Arab tourists, we need to change our image. And to do so, it would take time.
I think it's not just image, Yossi. Correct me if I'm wrong. Yes,
conflict.
It's stabilization, it's conflict resolution, it's negotiations, things that seems to be very far away from us today.
And everything comes to one thing, it's to the image. Because once you open the newspapers, and once you see the media, and once you watch Al Arabiya, and you see how Israel is being seen, for you're absolutely right, for right reasons, then we need a change here. We need to make a change here. But eventually, hopefully, and I'm optimistic, because I'm in tourism business, so I have to be optimistic. We need to look on a strategic level. We are part of this region. We have so much to offer. We eventually want and we need those tourists coming over. And when I look at tourism, me as an Israeli visiting Saudi Arabia, talking to locals and explaining them about the complexities of living in Israel and about the fact that I have a Muslim Arab friends and a Christian Arab friends and Jewish friends, and for them it was like a huge unknown. I look at myself when I'm traveling as an ambassador of the normal people in this country. And we have millions of normal people in this country. We have a minority which is not so normal. But this is the way I see it. Saudi wants to achieve a target of 100 million tourists in 2030. 100 million tourists. They want to be in one of the top five places in the world as a tourism country. In order to achieve that, they need peace and stability. If we want to be part of this neighborhood, we also need to have a peace and stability. So we have things in common, and we need to work on the things that we can have in common and to work jointly with those countries.
Yossi, thank you very much for your insights. Now, before we will say goodbye and ma'asalama, me and Ibrahim, we want to ask you three questions that we are going to pop to every guest of Ropes Cast. So the three questions are, and I will start with the one, then we'll go to Ibrahim, is what is your favorite place in the Middle East? It can be a place, it can be a city, it can be a country. Just very briefly, where do you feel the most comfortable, fun, and amazing?
Well, the most amazing place I visited through the years, and I'm talking now from my experiences back from 1995 to today in the Middle East, would be by far the Sultanate of Oman. It's a fairy tale country. It's a fairy tale country. I would highly recommend to Israelis that have dual nationality to go and visit this country. It's breathtaking. It's completely different to the rest of the Middle East. In the second place, I would definitely put the kingdom. However, the kingdom has still a lot of development that it needs to do in order to become a global destination.
If I was a betting man, I would have bet that you would have said Oman too. I've heard incredible things, and from some Omani friends I met throughout the years. A small other question that we have is, and you have to be very careful about how you answer this, is what's your favorite cuisine in the Middle East?
The favorite food.
Favorite dish.
The favorite cuisine would be by far Lebanese.
And a specific dish?
I would surprise you. I would actually surprise you. It would be the sauce, the Lebanese garlic sauce.
Really?
Oh my God. A garlic flour.
You did call me off guard. You called me off guard.
When you taste the real Lebanese garlic sauce, it's amazing. It's not that complicated to make. However, it's just so good, and it's complementing all the meat dishes. It's just perfect.
Well, Yossi, I can put it like this. I've been to Lebanon twice. And after tasting their mutabal and hummus and other places, it's just difficult for me to eat it in other places. Yes, I miss it very much. Our third question is, it's a deep question, so it's take a second to think about it. What is your vision of 2030? Because the kingdom certainly has its own 2030 vision. We and Ropes also have our own 2030 vision when we discuss regional integration, cooperation, and the post-conflict Middle East. What would you like to see? It's in 7 years from now?
Wow, that's I find it very, very difficult to answer this question because after I visited the kingdom, I went to visit the United Arab Emirates, where I spoke to local people, and one of the questions that I had for them is that don't they see a huge competition coming out from Saudi Arabia because of the Red Sea project? Would it compromise their own development? And what the answer I received was just I was amazed, and they said, no, we are just complementing each other. The entire region, the entire Gulf region, is going into a tremendous change, whereby they are changing their economies from a fossil based economies into a tourism based economies. We are tagging along. We are so far away from what these guys are doing. We can just try to catch a ride on their backs, but we are far, far away. We are light years away from them. We are tending to stay here in our own country in a small place and believe that we are in the center of the world. We are not. We are a small part in a big region, and we need to find ways to become an integral part of that region. If you look, for example, on the train infrastructure, the United Arab Emirates just finished their own train infrastructure, 1,200 kilometers long, and they are connecting it with the Sultanate of Oman. Eventually, they will connect it with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia itself will have a huge project of developing their own train infrastructure, high-speed infrastructure in Saudi Arabia. But you are talking about a country that is 2.15 million kilometers. This project would be probably the only country that can help the Saudis doing this project would be China, because they developed their own high-speed rail infrastructure within 10 years. The biggest infrastructure in the world of high-speed trains. So eventually, I hope that we will see trains connecting the ports of Haifa, the ports of Ashdod, with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and with the United Arab Emirates and Oman. Whether this would happen until 2030, only Allah knows.
That's a perfect way to end our conversation today. We thank you very much, Mr. Yossi Fischer, an expert on international tourism and consultant.
If you'll allow me, just
shukran. Toda rabba lecha to you and to all our listeners. And stay tuned.
If I can add, just I want to wish all your Muslim listeners, Ramadan Kareem, and all the blessings to you and to your families around the world.
Thank you very much, Yossi. We will definitely speak to you again about this fantastic developments and hopefully good news, scoops. We want scoops, Yossi. So let's wait for our next conversation as well. For now, thank you very much.
And thank you again for all our listeners for keeping up with us. And stay tuned for another episode of Ropescast.
Bye-bye. I just want to remind that there are more interesting and fascinating episodes of Ropecast. And you can find everything and, of course, subscribe at your favorite podcast platform, wherever you are listening to it. And if you want to seek more information about our organizations, we advise you to go to the website ropes.org. And if you want to become a guest at our podcast one day, there is an email. Please write it down, info@ropes.org.
Thank you, shukran, ve toda rabba for all of you for listening to us today. And we hope to have you on our next episode here at the Ropescast. Stay tuned.